56. Winding up the 20th. Abramson, meanwhile, lay as before, shoulder and cheek snug against a plump pillow, greedily devouring the Count of Monte Cristo. He had turned his back on the proceedings. Courtroom comedy did not appeal to him. He did look around briefly when Chilnoff spoke, because the details were new to him. At one time, Abramson was easily aroused to a frenzy of eloquence, and could hold forth endlessly without getting hoarse. But 20 years of exile, transit prisons, investigation centres, solitary confinement, labour camps and charashkas, had left him insensitive and indifferent to suffering, his own and that of those around him. The mock trial that had just taken place was dedicated to the fate of the 1945-46 stream. Abramson could acknowledge theoretically that the fate of former POWs was tragic, but they were only one stream, one of many, and not the most remarkable. Insofar as the ex-prisoners of war were interesting, it was because they had seen many foreign lands. Real, live, false witnesses, Potapov jokingly called them. But all in all, their stream was an undistinguished one. They were merely helpless victims of war, not people who had voluntarily chosen political struggle as their way of life. Every stream of Zeks into the NKVD pool, like each new generation of people on Earth, has its own history and its own heroes. And it is difficult for one generation to understand another. As Abramson saw it, these people could not possibly be compared with titans like himself, who, at the end of the 20s, voluntarily chose banishment to the Yenisei when they could have retracted what they had said at party meetings and gone on living comfortably. They were all given the choice. But these were people who could not bear the distortion and degradation of the revolution, and were ready to sacrifice themselves to sanitize it. This youthful tribe unknown had entered the cells 30 years after the October Revolution and simply repeated, with a sprinkling of peasant obscenities, the very things for which the Chequers' execution squads had shot, burned, and drowned people in the Civil War. So Abramson, although he felt no personal hostility to particular ex-POWs, and never argued with them individually, did not like the breed as a whole. In any case, he had, or so he assured himself, long since ceased to react to arguments, confessions, and eyewitness accounts from fellow prisoners. He had long lost the curiosity he may have felt in his youth about what was being said in another corner of the cell. Once he had lived for his work, but his enthusiasm had long ago burned itself out. He could not live for his family because he was not from Moscow. He was never allowed visitors, and letters that came to the Sharashka had been unwittingly drained of the juices of real life by their writers before the censor ever saw them. Nor did he let the newspapers hold his attention. A glance at the headlines made it obvious what the paper would be saying. He could listen to music on the radio for not more than 1 hour a day, and his nerves could simply not stand programs consisting of words or lying books. So that although somewhere deep inside himself, beyond 7 defensive barriers, he had preserved not just a lively but a painfully acute interest in what was happening in the world, and to the creed to which he had dedicated his life. Externally, he affected total indifference to everything around him. The Trotskyist who had survived his turn to be shot, starved to death, or harried into the grave, now preferred not books red hot with truth, but those that diverted him and helped to while away his interminable sentence. Ah, but in 1929, out in the taiga, on the Yenisei, they had not been reading Monte Cristo. Pretending that it was to celebrate the new year, they flocked to the distant village of Dushani on the Angara, which was reached by a 300-verst sledge track through the taiga, from places 100 versts deeper into the forest, for a conference of exiles on their country's situation, international and domestic. It was more than 58 degrees below zero. The slow but sure iron stove in the corner was quite inadequate to warm the exaggeratedly spacious Siberian hut. The built-in Russian stove was in ruins, which was why the hut had been given to the exiles. The walls of the hut were frozen through. At intervals, in the dead of night, the timbers would emit a sharp sound like a rifle shot. The conference opened with a report by Satanievich on the policy of the party in the countryside. He took off his cap, releasing an unruly black forelock, but kept on his short fur coat with the eternal English phrase-book, "We must know our enemy," sticking out of one pocket. Satanevich always assumed the role of leader. He was, so it was said, subsequently shot during a strike at Vorkuta. In his report, Satanevich recognized the rational kernel of the party's policy. The conservative peasantry had to be curbed by draconian Stalinist methods, or else the tide of reaction would inundate the cities and drown the revolution. It was time now to admit that the peasantry had overwhelmed the cities anyway, drowned them in a petty bourgeois flood, drowned even the party apparatus that had been sapped by purges, and so destroyed the revolution. Alas, the more passionate the debates were, the more they damaged the unity of the puny group of exiles. It became clear that there were not just two opinions, not just three, but as many as there were people. Toward morning, too tired to go on, they would wind up the official part of the conference without agreeing on a resolution. Then they ate and drank from the state's crockery, decoratively nestling among fir twigs that hid the ruts and ragged splinters of the table. The thawing twigs smelled of snow and resin and pricked people's hands. They drank moonshine liquor. They proposed toasts and swore that none of those present would ever capitulate and sign a recantation. A political storm would break in the Soviet Union any month now. Then they sang famous revolutionary songs. La Varsovienne, "Our banner flutters over the whole world," "The Black Baron." And they went on arguing about anything and everything. Rosa, who had worked in a Kharkov tobacco factory, had sat on her feather mattress. She had brought it with her from the Ukraine to Siberia, and was very proud of the fact, smoking one cigarette after another and scornfully tossing her short, curly hair. "I can't stand intellectuals. They revolt me with their fine distinctions and complications. Human psychology is much simpler than pre-revolutionary writers choose to portray it. Our task is to free humanity from its superfluous spiritual burdens." Somehow or other, they got around to women's jewellery. One exile, Patrushev, formerly a public prosecutor in the Crimea, whose fiancée had in fact recently come from Russia to see him, exclaimed defiantly, "Why do you want to make the society of the future poorer than it need be? Why shouldn't I dream of a time when every girl will be able to wear pearls, when every man will be able to crown the bride of his choice with a diadem?" What an uproar this had created! How furiously they had pelted him with quotations from Marx and Plekhanov, from Campanella to Feuerbach. The society of the future! How confidently they talked about it! The sun rose on the new year, the 1930th, and they all went outside to admire it. It was a bracing frosty morning, with columns of pink smoke rising straight toward the pink sky. Women were driving cattle along the broad white Angara to their watering place, a hole in the ice with fir logs around it. The men of the village and their horses were nowhere to be seen. They had been packed off to fell and haul timber. 2 decades went by. The causes they had toasted lost their bloom and their relevance. Those who remained firm to the end were shot, and those who capitulated were shot just the same. Abramson was left behind with his memories, and an understanding of those years that matured unseen in one sharashka after another, like a sapling under a bell jar. Abramson's eyes were on his book, but not reading, when Nyazhin came and sat on the edge of his bed. They had met first in a cell in Butyrki prison 3 years before. Potapov was in the same cell. Abramson was nearing the end of his first 10-year jail sentence at the time, and his cellmates were impressed by this experienced prisoner's air of ice-cold authority, his deep-rooted scepticism about prison matters. But secretly he cherished the insane hope that he would shortly return to his family. They had gone their different ways. Abramson was, in fact, shortly released by some oversight, and was free just long enough for his family to pull up stakes and move to Sterle Tamak, where the militia was willing to give him a residence permit. But no sooner had his family moved than they pulled him in, subjected him to a single interrogation, in which he was asked whether he was indeed the Abramson who had been in exile from 1929 to 1934, and since then in jail. Having established that he had in fact served and completed, and even somewhat exceeded, the term to which he had been sentenced, the special tribunal rewarded him for it with a further 10 years. Those in charge of the special prisons, Sharashkas, discovered from the main all-union card index that their former employee was inside again and promptly yanked him out to work for them. Abramson was transported to Morfino, where, as you always do in the convict world, he met old acquaintances, Nyerzhin and Potapov among them. When they stood together on the stairway, smoking, Abramson felt as though he had not spent a year as a free man at home with his family, had not rewarded his wife with an additional daughter, felt that it had all been the sort of cruel dream that breaks a prisoner's heart, and that prison was the only concrete reality in this world. Nyerzhin had sat down by Abramson to invite him to his birthday party. Abramson belatedly wished him many happy returns, and, squinting from under his glasses, asked who would be there. The realization that he would have to struggle into his overalls, ruining the Sunday hours that would have been so pleasantly and profitably spent in his underwear, and that he would have to abandon an entertaining book for what they called a birthday party, gave Abramson no pleasure at all. The worst of it was that he did not expect to have a good time, but was more or less certain that a political argument would flare up, as futile and as unrewarding as ever, and that it would be impossible not to get involved and equally impossible to let himself be involved, because revealing his most private thoughts to junior prisoners would be like exhibiting his wife in the nude. Nyerzhin went through the guest list. Rubin was the only one in the Sharashka who was on close terms with Abramson, though he would have to be told off for today's farce, which was unworthy of a true communist. Sologdin and Priantchikov Abramson did not like. Though, strangely enough, Rubin and Sologdin were supposed to be friends, perhaps because they had been neighbours on the bedboards at Butyrki. The prison administration made little distinction between them, and when the November anniversary celebrations came around, whisked them off to Lefortovo for a holiday away from it all. Still, Abramson could not refuse the invitation. He was informed that the merrymaking would begin in half an hour's time, between Potapov's and Priantchikov's beds, just as soon as Andreich had made the artificial cream. While they were talking, Nyerzhin noticed what Abramson was reading and said, "As it happens, I once started rereading Monte Cristo in prison, but didn't finish it. I couldn't help noticing that although Dumas tries to make the reader's flesh creep, the Chateau d'If, as he portrays it, is a thoroughly patriarchal prison. Never mind his disregard of such nice little details as the daily carrying out of the night bucket. Dumas doesn't mention it because, being a free man, he never thinks of it. Just ask yourself why Dantes succeeded in escaping. Because, of course, there were no cell searches for years on end, although they are supposed to be carried out weekly. Consequently, their tunnelling went undiscovered. Then again, the screws in charge of them were not relieved regularly, though, as we know from experience of the Lubyanka, they should be changed every 2 hours, so that the next guard can look for signs that the one before has been negligent. Furthermore, nobody entered or peeped into the cells at the Chateau d'If from one morning to the next. There weren't even any spy holes in the doors. In short, it wasn't a prison, but a seaside holiday resort. They thought nothing of leaving a metal saucepan in a cell, and Dantes used it to scoop a hole in the floor. To cap it all, they trustingly sewed the dead man up in a sack, without first branding his body with a red-hot iron in the morgue, then failed to pierce it with a bayonet in the guardhouse. Dumas should have worried less about atmosphere and more about elementary procedure. Nyerzhin never read just for amusement. What he looked for in a book were allies and enemies. He reached a precisely formulated verdict on every book he read, and liked to force it on others. Abramson, who knew this tiresome habit of his, listened without raising his head from the pillow, observing him calmly through his square glasses. "All right, I'll be there," he said, then made himself more comfortable, and went on with his reading.